Critical Readings, a podcast of literary discussion and analysis, starring Sean Philip Cooper, Drew Keen, and Jack Tyler. Hello and welcome to Critical Readings, episode 122 for the 4th of April, 2022. I'm Dr. Cooper, and with me today I have two panelists. They are Drew Keen.
Salutations.
And Jack Tyler.
Thanks for having me.
Greetings, gentlemen. Well, we have a titan of letters today, a man robbed unjustly of the poet laureateship by the prolonged lifespan of Alfred Lord Tennyson. Had he but kicked the bucket a little earlier, we might all now know the name Owen Meredith, rolling off of our tongues every single day as we quote his verses one to another. But sadly, it was not to be, and he remains something of a literary footnote, and we will therefore delve into his magnificent, simply magnificent verse today. And we have some really cracking selections lined up for you. We have a bit from his most important and extremely long poem, Lucille. We would love to spend 15 weeks on it. We really wish we could, but sadly, one just doesn't have the time. But we'll look at a little bit, a representative sample of Lucille. We'll investigate his knowledge of the chessboard with a selection from Jack Tyler. And then we will look at a song, one of his unjustly named minor poems, for there is nothing minor about the poetry of Owen Meredith, not a single thing. But one of his less major poems, we'll call them that, one of his less major poems, we'll look at a song, and we'll examine its choice of vocabulary, its diction, its syntax, its superior rhyme, its magnificent metricality, its just absolutely subtle selection of sound and meaning. But first, let's talk a
little
bit
about sound and sense, perhaps.
What's that?
Sound and sense.
Sound and sense, that's right. The subtleness of sound and sense, syntax. All right, we'll have a little biography of Owen Meredith. Owen Meredith, not his name, it's worth pointing out. It was a pseudonym, a pen name. He was, in fact, Edward Robert Lytton, Bulwer Lytton. That's Lytton, Bulwer Lytton, you've got it. Commonly just known as Robert Bulwer Lytton. He was the first Earl of Lytton. His father, noble Lord Lytton, was a baron, but his son became an earl for services to the crown, particularly Queen Victoria, for whom he was British ambassador to France, and then far more importantly, or I shouldn't say and then, preceding that, far more importantly, Viceroy and Governor General of India. And when he came back, they sent him to France. And he was a conservative politician, an English statesman. As you can figure, of course, he was Viceroy of India. He set up one of the Delhi Durbars there. He presided over India during one of the Great Famines. Has not particularly been treated kindly by history. His son, the second Earl of Lytton, was governor of Bengal and also briefly acting viceroy, formally. And his son-in-law was, of course, famously Sir Edwin Lutyens, and he designed New Delhi. So they were really tied up in Indian affairs, the Lyttons. And he was a protege of Benjamin Disraeli, of course, who was always banging the drum for empire. Okay, so let's talk about him a little bit. Oh, I should put out one more thing. When he died, he was given a state funeral in France, in Paris, no less. And that is extraordinary, because, of course, he's an Englishman. That's very, very rare. But he was very well regarded as British ambassador to France, and as was his predecessor, the Viscount Lyon, or Lyon, who was also very well loved. Okay, let's talk about his writings a little bit. When he was 25, he published a little slim volume of poems in London under the name Owen Meredith, and then he published several other volumes under the same pseudonym, and the most popular today still and then was Lucille, which was published in 1860. It's a story in verse, right? It's very, very, very long. His poetry was extremely popular, and it was critically acclaimed in his own lifetime, as was his father. Now, many people didn't know immediately that Owen Meredith was Robert Bulwer Lytton, but eventually that fact was discovered, and it only added to his prestige. For his father, the Lord Lytton, was extraordinarily famous as an author of novels. And we still remember his father today, don't we, Jack?
Mm-hmm. We do. He's most remembered for his namesake Bulwer Lytton Literary Fiction Award, and which is in honor of his famous "Dark and Stormy Night" sentence. The contest is one that is dedicated to producing the worst sentence of prose for an imaginary novel.
Indeed. And his father, of course, who gave us this long and terrible opening line, was...
Would you like me to read it for us?
Oh, could you? That would be fine. I think we should.
I could.
Yes,
I
please
could.
Do.
This is the opening line to the 1830 novel, Paul Clifford. It was a dark and stormy night. The rain fell in torrents, except at occasional intervals when it was checked by a violent gust of wind which swept up the streets, for it is in London that our scene lies, rattling along the housetops and fiercely agitating the scanty flame of the lamps that struggled against the darkness.
That's excellent. Thank you.
Oh, it really does create a mood, though.
Scanty flame struggling against the darkness.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps that could be a tagline for our podcast. I don't know.
Well,
so would it be the case? I mean, this is a question I don't know because I've never spent any time with Owen Meredith. Is it the case that he used a pseudonym in order to not seem as if he was riding on his father's coattails, or was it an attempt to not seem as if he was using his lordship as a self-promotion? What was the motive for using a pen name?
My guess, and I don't know, is that in general, as a young man, he probably wouldn't have wanted to be associated with his verses in case they were not particularly well received, right? It might bring...
Well, protection for his political career.
Yeah, for his political career and his family's reputation, because he did not have a very high opinion of his own work. He wrote a lot. It's worth saying, and I have a volume of his poems here, and it's 408 pages long. So it's not a small body of work, but he had a very poor opinion of his own work, which was at odds with the public's impression, and he was primarily focused on politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a politician from a young age in his 20s, and for most of his life, and he occupied many of those, you know, highest roles in the land, short of the premiership. So I think probably when he started out, there was a concern about his political career, concern about, you know, what if these poems are received badly? You know, this could be dangerous, you know, especially if you're a politician, they're going to follow you around, right? People are going to be shouting your terrible verses at you when you're trying to give speeches and stuff. So, but that proved unfounded because, of course, you know, they were successful. And then shortly after that, you know, the pseudonym was accompanied by his name because evidently it was no longer necessary. He was no longer, you know, concerned.
That did sometimes happen to the American politician John Hay, who wrote published poetry in his younger days and felt haunted by it in his mature statesman phase.
Yes. That's what you want, is people shouting your worst couplets at you, right? So in the edition I have, which is published sometime in the very late 19th century, late 1880s or 1890s, it reads, "The poetical works of Owen Meredith," and then in parentheses and smaller text, "Robert, Lord Lytton." And, you know, by the later part of the 19th century, it was everyone knew who Owen Meredith was, and there was no need anymore to protect himself. Not everything was received well. When he published Chronicles and Characters in 1868, it received a rather cool response, and he was distressed by this. I guess he'd kind of grown accustomed to success by this point. And he wrote, "Talk not of genius baffled. Genius is master of man. Genius does what it must, and talent does what it can." But Oscar Wilde thought it fantastic and dedicated Lady Windermere's Fan to him. So, and he was an astute judge of talent. So his major works, Clytemnestra, 1855, The Wanderer, which is a sort of Byronic poem, extremely popular at the time in 1859. Lucille in 1860, he was accused of plagiarizing George Sand's novel Lavinia. He did, in fact, lift some verses from a few other people, which were expunged in later editions. He wrote Srpski pesme in 1861, which he plagiarized from a French translation of Serbian poems. He had this problem. He was frequently accused of plagiarism. And this was.
I think we should say a bit about that, because it's an accusation that wouldn't have been made 100 years before.
No.
So it's directly the result of new copyright laws and a new set of assumptions about intellectual property that didn't exist, especially in literary culture, in just 100 years before. So poets were expected to build on each other's work and to adapt each other's work. And, you know, citation is not a common convention for poetry. You're to echo and allude to and reference other poetry without signaling that to the reader. You Indeed. Expect the reader to simply know it.
Well, he came in for a bit of critique in it, because people were beginning to expect this by the 19th century, expecting right. citation. And so when he wrote his Tannhäuser, or The Battle of the Bards, he made sure to include a small line in italics, subscript above the text and below the title, a portion of this poem was written by another hand. There you go. Problem solved. Not exactly what we'd call specific, but nevertheless. He married Edith Villiers.
As publishers and writers were trying to figure out how to deal with the new expectations and the new copyright laws, that this is an early form of trying to deal with that. You know, it's not what we would do now, but they were writing a whole new book of rules at this point.
Indeed. Well, he eventually married Edith Villiers of the very famous Villiers family. Of course, one Villiers was Duke of Buckingham, you may recall. And they had at least 7 children.
Did
they lose one?
I'm certain.
Lose track of a few along the way?
It's difficult to tell. You know, there may have been deaths in infancy, and, you know, who knows who was owned. It was the 19th century. Yeah. There's not much detail.
Well, when there's 7, you know, on your way out of the Cheesecake Factory, one of them might slip into the kitchen or.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, whatever. There'd be no way of knowing.
That's why you have so many, just in case.
In case
one or two wander off. Exactly.
Exactly.
So the children were an Edward Rowland John, a Lady Elizabeth Edith Betty, a Lady Constance Georgina, the Honorable Henry Meredith Edward, Lady Emily, Victor, and Neville. And Victor and Neville were eventually Earls Lytton in due course. Victor was the 2nd Earl, and Neville was the 3rd Earl Lytton. And I don't know if he had any sons. He might have been the last. He was in the Olympics with Neville Bulwer Lytton, 3rd Earl Lytton. He won the bronze in 1908 in the men's Jeu de Paume. Oh. Do they still do the Jeu de Paume? That's a question.
I don't know.
Oh, there was a 4th Earl Lytton. Noel Anthony Scowen Lytton, 4th Earl, was a British Army officer and a fancier of Arabian horses. So there you go. And he went to Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. And he had a son, John Peter Michael Scowen Lytton, 5th Earl. And he's still around, the 5th Earl Lytton. So the direct descendant of Owen Meredith lives on. He was born in 1950, and he's in the House of Lords, the Right Honorable, the Earl of Lytton, 5th Earl. And he's 72. I wonder if he writes poetry. In any case, his seat has been abolished, and it will disappear. So that will be sad when he...
Okay.
When he pips off. Yeah. House of Lords Act 1999 did for that. But, you know.
Yes.
All those hereditary peerages gone. I think it's going to be quite sad about that, frankly. But
Well, there are still a small number of hereditary peers that are left with a seat.
Yeah, but just
yeah, for the most part, now ones. It's political appointments of celebrity peers.
Exactly. I'd rather have the hereditary peers than the celebrities, I think, is the thing, right? Okay. Well, let's get to the verses. Oh, we didn't mention that we mentioned that when he died, he had a state funeral in Paris. Yes, okay. He's not buried in Westminster Abbey or anything. It wasn't that good, just to be clear. It wasn't like they had to bury his heart in one place and his body in the Abbey. No. It's all in one piece, Bulwer Lytton. Well, let's begin. Let's look at his most famous work of all, Lucille, published in 1860. And we can't read all of it. As I said, it's extremely long. But he dedicated it to his father, Baron Lytton, Edward Bulwer Lytton. the novelist. There was some strife between Edward Bulwer-Lytton and his son for a little bit. I don't really recall what this is, and I don't think Wikipedia mentions it, but I read it somewhere that I believe Robert Bulwer-Lytton, his son, was accused of plagiarizing the father, Edward Bulwer-Lytton. And this led to a little bit of bad blood between them for a while. But by 1860, or at least preceding 1860, things had cooled sufficiently that he was able to receive a dedication from his son, although it was signed Owen Meredith, so he might not have known who it was. Dedicated to him, maybe he didn't know. That would have been unfortunate. In any case, I really wish I could find that little anecdote about why they were at odds, but I don't see it here, which makes me sad. Racine Doyle and the death of Bulwer's exhaustion by chance, Captain Claridge. Yeah, it doesn't say, but there was something unpleasant between them for a little bit. But it got sorted out in the end. So here's the dedication. Why don't we read that, and then we'll read the selection we have. Here's Owen Meredith to his father. I don't know if his father knew, but anyway. I dedicate... Oh, no, it says to my father. Okay, well, there you go. So he knew. Either that or he was like, wait, Owen Meredith? Maybe that carriage girl. No, couldn't be. You'd hope that he wouldn't have known and that he wasn't thinking, oh, maybe it was some girl. Random. But no. To my father, I dedicate to you a work which is submitted to the public with a diffidence and hesitation proportioned to the novelty of the effort it represents. For in this poem, I have abandoned those forms of verse with which I had most familiarized my thoughts, and have endeavored to follow a path on which I could discover no footprints before me either to guide or to warn. There is a moment of profound discouragement which succeeds to prolonged effort. When, the labor which has become a habit having ceased, we miss the sustaining sense of its companionship and stand, with a feeling of strangeness and embarrassment, before the abrupt and naked result. As regards myself, in the present instance, the force of all such sensations is increased by the circumstances to which I have referred. And in this moment of discouragement and doubt, my heart instinctively turns to you, from whom it has so often sought, from whom it has never failed to receive support. I do not inscribe to you this book because it contains anything that is worthy of the beloved and honored name with which I thus seek to associate it, nor yet because I would avail myself of a vulgar pretext to display in public an affection that is best honored by the silence which it renders sacred. Feelings only such as those with which, in days when there existed for me no critic less gentle than yourself, I have brought to you my childish manuscripts. Feelings only such as those which have, in later years, associated with your heart all that is moved or occupied my own. Lead me once more to seek assurance from the grasp of that hand which has hitherto been my guide and comfort through the life I owe to you. And as in childhood, when existence had no toil beyond the day's simple lesson, no ambition beyond the neighboring approval of the night, I brought to you the morning's task for the evening's sanction. So now I bring to you this self-appointed taskwork of maturer years, less confident indeed of your approval, but not less confident of your love, and anxious only to realize your presence between myself and the public, and to mingle with those severer voices to whose final sentence I submit my work, the beloved and gracious accents of your own. Owen Meredith. That's a very ornate. All right.
It's also completely within the standard dedication epistles of the time, too. They were always ornate.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually identify who the father is. So
no, it doesn't.
The Earl wouldn't necessarily have, unless they had talked about it themselves,
might not know
who this was dedicated to. Yeah.
That'd be the worst part. You write all that and then your dad doesn't even know. That was for me? If I wrote that, my dad wouldn't know.
Well, I mean, it was more for the reader than it is for anyone else.
Yeah.
He wants the reader to see him as paying this kind of homage to his father, but
it is very
the reader doesn't have any
kind
clue there about who his father is.
Yeah. It's
interesting
nice
that he comments on the novelty of the form. Which I think warrants some attention here because it's a form that we no longer use. There are lots of experiments in this time for how to extend the epic into modernity. And there were many, I think, abortive attempts at that.
Here's
and
one.
Including the verse novel. The verse novels were very popular. And they were one of those attempts to see how the epic might survive into modernity.
We also have this with its weird like dialogue poem.
Well, that's what I was about to say next.
Yeah.
The novel itself was still in a great deal of flux. So you'll get novels that are just written as if they were a series of letters back and forth between people You also get some novels that are completely in dialogue, and that seems to be the way this is set up. So it's a poem, it's a novel, and it's all in dialogue.
Yes, it's very strange. And you read it and you don't wonder why it didn't catch on. You're like, ah.
But it did at the time.
Well, yes, but only briefly, though. That's the thing, right? Yeah. And then it lived, it flamed, it died. And although I say that, but Robert Frost, his dialogue poems. Now, granted, they're not written in dialogue. They don't have the names of the speakers. But, I mean, that's effectively what they are, right? So.
Oh, yes. And, almost all ancient bucolic verses, almost all in dialogue.
So there is a tradition of this, but this attempt to resurrect the epic or to recast it in 19th century English verse, it sadly didn't work. It really hasn't worked. Has anyone succeeded? When was the last time we had an English epic? Paradise Lost.
There were some. Well, the Paradise Lost is really the last great attempt, the one that's really successful.
Yeah,
and
of course,
then poetic translations of epics became massively successful.
That's true. Yeah.
Dryden and Pope's, but Pope, you know, failed in his attempt to write an English epic about Brutus, the founding Britain. There were some early 20th century English epics, but they're not widely read or known today.
No, they're not very good. It's really Milton.
Well, Milton should ask Clinton about this. I think that's his area of research, isn't it?
Yes, the new epics. He had a copy of the Five Quintets by Michael O. Tidhale, and that's it sounds like an Irish author writing an English epic. Celebrated Irish poet Michael O'Siddle structures his quintets to echo the comedy, where Dante had a tripartite structure. O'Siddle has a five-part structure devoted to a discipline: the arts, economics, politics, science, philosophy, and theology. So there's Michael, if you're out there listening, there's a free advertisement for one of our late English epics, one of our 21st century epics.
Yeah.
So.
Remarkable.
I mean, lots of people Tennyson thought of doing it. That was what Idols of the King was originally going to be. It was going to be an epic about King Arthur. And it's a very first thoughts. And then he realized that was unworkable for whatever reason and said, no, that can't be done. So instead it became the Idols, which we'll be reading this summer. So stay tuned for that if you're interested. But no one's ever pulled this off. Well, in any case, we'll give the Earl of Lytton credit here for trying. And Lucille is very long, and it doesn't contain an appeal to the muse or two or three or four. So we're going to read one. Here, this is from part two. It's in several parts. Canto one. You'll see that right off the bat, it's not exactly Milton. So I'll read a bit of it, and then we'll turn it over to Jack to take us to the chessboard. Canto 1 of Part 2 of Lucille by Owen Meredith, the Earl of Lytton. Hail Muse! But each muse by this time has, I know, been used up, and Apollo has bent his own bow all too long. So I leave unassaulted the portal of Olympus, and only invoke here a mortal. Hail Murray! Not Lindley, but Murray and Son. Hail, omniscient, beneficent, great, two in one. In Albemarle Street, may thy temple long stand, long enlightened and led by thine erudite hand. Mage novice in science nomadic unravel statistical mazes of modernized travel. Mage innkeeper knave, long thy judgment revere, and the postboys of Europe regard thee with fear, while they feel, in the silence of baffled extortion, that knowledge is power. Long, long, like that portion of the national soil which the Greek exile took in his baggage wherever he went, may thy book cheer each poor British pilgrim who trusts to thy wit not to pay through his nose just for following it. Mayst thou long, O instructor, preside o'er his way, and teach him alike what to praise and to pay. Thee, perusing this pathway of song, once again I invoke, lest unskilled I should wander in vain. To my call be propitious, nor churlish refuse thy great accents to lend to the lips of my muse. For I sing of the naiads, who dwell mid the stems of the green linden trees by the water of Ems. Yes, thy spirit descend upon mine, O John Murray, and I start with thy book for the baths in a hurry. I quite like this. It's clearly a little bit of a joke, a bit of fun, right?
Well, perhaps even sounds more than it was meant to. Part of it's the anapestic meter.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think we associate that more with light verse than we do with epic verse.
an epic and anapests would be
yeah,
most
but that's
unfitting.
What he's attempting. And then because it's in a modern 19th century setting,
mm-hmm.
the poetic elevation of it sounds almost mock heroic.
Indeed.
In a kind of, dunciad way.
Well, no, but I think there are some deliberate, I think there is deliberate jesting in here. Cheer each poor British pilgrim who trusts to thy wit not to pay through his nose just for following it.
Yeah, that's definitely intentionally funny.
It's a wonderful pun, though, right? You know, to pay through his nose just for following it. To pay for following his nose, you must pay through his nose. It's quite clever, actually.
The whole thing is in this particular metrical form, mm-hmm. though, and I think it doesn't seem to hold together in my ear.
Well, the enjambments, I think there are a lot of enjambments here, and they kind of work against the anapestic form, which, you know, with those really firm end stopped, you know, lines, those really firm stresses on the final beat of every line, you kind of want a nice closed line. I guess that would make it more song like and even more mock epic. Maybe that's why he avoids it. But I mean, the tone and the content doesn't push against it, right? And there are some lines that are practically, you know, W.S. Gilbertian. Mage, novice, and science nomadic unravel statistical mazes of modernized travel. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's absolutely tremendous. You can imagine, you know, Sullivan looking at that, just rubbing his hands to set it to music. He'd be delighted at the possibilities. But that the invocation to the muse at the beginning, right? But, you know, then the admission, the muses are all used up.
Right.
They've all been invoked.
Problem, he basically admits the difficulty of trying to do an epic in the 19th century,
yeah.
is that everyone had the sense that the muses were used up, that they were dead. And so what do you do at that point?
Well, you invoke Murray and Son in Albemarle Street.
Well, and it's also interesting that the poem doesn't begin with an invocation of the muse. This is the beginning of part two. Part one doesn't begin like this.
Indeed, this is the second part. This is not the first part.
Invoking the muses for a second wind.
And
what a muse!
Keep going,
right? What a muse, John Murray and Son. These are. This is publisher. I'm not really sure what's going on here. Right? Is this a bank?
Sounds like a lawyer.
Yeah, it's some sort of office, right? That is clearly known to him. But not to me, John Murray and Son, Albemarle Street, publishing house. See, there it is. It is his publisher. 50 Albemarle Street, the center of a literary circle. See, I know I've heard of this. Yeah, I think he was involved with Sir Walter Scott. I think that's why. But in any case, so he's invoking his publisher as his muse, which I think is one way.
It's like a very 19th century commercial thing.
Yeah, it's you know, that's what this is about, right? Look at the commercialism in it, right? It's about the commercial sphere of the 19th century. It's about the post boys of Europe and the Greek exile with his baggage and the British pilgrim, right? They're all traveling. They're all spending money. They're all engaged in this new mercantile, modernized, as they say, modernized travel, right? The world of modernized travel and science,
yep.
and quantitative metrics, statistics. And what presides over them all? Murray and Son, the publisher. And there's a certain truth to that. It's like we talk about how the media is the great power of the day. But in the 19th century, it was the publishing houses.
This, too, is, I think, part of the project of bringing epic into the 19th century, because epic was always included references to the bards, right? Mm. The sources of information about the war or the rest of the world, you know, the poets. And what's the equivalent of that in the 19th century but a publisher?
That's right.
And also, epics were supposed to contain an epitome of the knowledge of the civilization. So you have to incorporate science into it. I mean, even Milton does that with his conversation between Adam and Raphael, where he's talking about the arrangement of the heavens. And Milton is aware of the debate about the heliocentric and geocentric model. And he just has Raphael say, well, you know, you should be worried about things on this planet, not worried about the arrangement of the heavens. So he avoids answering the question.
It makes one wonder what this would look like in the 21st century, right? Like you'd have I don't know, something like, oh, gods of the media who are followed by most, the cable news network and Huffington Post. Something like that, right? Where it would be about our modern media.
That's my blue checkered news.
Yeah. Exactly, right? Maybe this is why the modern epic can't succeed. Our sources of information are simply too risible. If you try to bring them into your work, you succeed only in undermining it. Mm-hmm. And we see that here, right? I mean, you bring up Murray and Son, omniscient, beneficent, two in one rather than three in one, right? The holy, you know,
divinity.
Divinity, right? Diunity.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is sort of mock heroic. Although the work, we should be clear, the work isn't written in this kind of jocular vein. The story of Lucille is a serious one. It's about, you know, love and loss and so on and so forth. I have to admit, I've never read it.
Typical 19th century novel.
Yeah, it's like every 19th century novel. I've not read it all because it is somewhat interminable. But it is a serious work. It is not meant to be silly. And yet, in this beginning part, it is a little silly.
That's another part of the problem, though, is that the subject matter of a novel, and remember, in the 19th century, the novel isn't as venerated as we now think. And now we sort of think the novel has consumed all other forms of great literature. But at this time, it hadn't. And novels were for domestic matters, especially matters of romance. And epics were not. Epics were about major public events. So the melding together of the novel with its domestic focus and the epic with its public focus is quite an experiment.
Well, for example, this is Canto 1 of the second part, and it's divided into verses. That's verse 1 we just read. But if I just jump, it's just a little bit forward to 4. Yes, to 4. Now, the version I've got is illustrated. I have an illustrated Lucille, which is about as riveting as you might expect. And I bring it out at every dinner party. Say, look at my illustrated Lucille. Please pay attention. So here is verse 4 of Canto 1 of Part 2. So you can see it's not done moving to the totally serious yet, but just listen to the change in tone. 3 verses later. For the blessings life lends us, it strictly demands the worth of their full usufruct at our hands. And the value of all things exists not indeed in themselves, but man's use of them, feeding man's need. Alfred Vargrave, in wedding with beauty and youth, had embraced both ambition and wealth, yet in truth unfulfilled the ambition and sterile the wealth. In a life paralyzed by a moral ill health, had remained, while the beauty and youth, unredeemed from a vague disappointment at all things, but seemed day by day to reproach him in silence for all that lost youth in himself they had failed to recall. No career had he followed, no object obtained in the world by those worldly advantages gained from nuptials beyond which once seemed to appear, lit by love, the broad path of a brilliant career. All that glittered and gleamed through the moonlight of youth with a glory so fair, now that manhood in truth grasped and gathered it, seemed like that false fairy gold which leaves in the hand only moss, leaves, and mold. So there's like a moral lesson being conveyed here. This is very serious. But I do think that the anapestic...
It doesn't leader, strike the right tone.
No, it... You really, we are living well downstream of the 19th century. And what has endured from the 19th century for the common reader? Has Lucille endured? No. What has endured? There was a young barmaid from Yale. On her breast were the prices of ale, but on her behind, for the sake of the blind, was exactly the same, but in Braille. That's what's endured. the limerick. Yeah. Right. The limerick is the anapestic verse par excellence for us. And what is it?
Yes.
It's seedy and, you know, vaguely vulgar and loping along. And so when we hear anapestic verse, I think it connects us to that. kind of silly. But
there also was no precedent for anapestic heroic verse either. So no. It is
Can
an
you imagine
experiment
Homer in anapests? Heaven forfend.
But it does seem like it's possible for it to work. I mean, so Byron's Death of Sennacherib is in anapestic.
It is
couplets, and it works.
It does work.
Verse.
As we read on this podcast, it does work. But it's so much shorter, right? It's four stanzas.
Yeah.
And it's preoccupied with rendering an ancient battle into approachable natural metaphors, right?
Yeah.
We've got the stars and the sea on the waves of blue Galilee. And we've got like the leaves in the autumn, right? So we take these ancient kind of misty images from the Bible, and we render them into the approachable natural metaphors, and we make a moral point. We do it in four stanzas of couplets, quatrains of couplets, right? And it's over.
So, yeah, it's unlikely that could have been sustained over the course of a whole epic.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Maybe Byron could.
If anybody could.
That's just Byron, right?
Yeah.
I mean, okay. There's Byron, and then there's Owen Meredith. And they're not really the same thing. So I think this is the problem. I do see here there are gems. There are moments maybe hidden, but the enjambments don't work for me. They make it, and also as we've seen from his dedication, Owen Meredith struggled to put things concisely.
Yes.
Or to express himself directly. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. It's not the concision that's really the problem. But there are so many interpolating clauses. It's the same problem his father had, which is why that opening sentence to Paul Clifford is so widely, you know, derided. It's unable to do directly the thing that it sets out to do, right? Which is just to set the scene and get on with the story. It keeps getting distracted with another clause. We have a clause and a clause.
Yeah, a bit serpentine in its syntax. And, you know, that's the – so often bad 19th century poetry has been accused of following too closely Pope and Dryden. But T.S. Eliot said actually he thought it was the bad imitation of Milton, and in particular Milton's serpentine syntax.
Yes.
That made for most of the bad 19th century poetry. Because when Milton decided to do blank verse, he had to do something else to make it sound poetic if he didn't have rhyme. And
exactly.
So what was his solution but to adopt Latinate syntax?
Mm-hmm. And it works,
which is precisely
because you're only focusing on that, right? There's nothing else to focus on.
Right.
But here you've got, you know, this anapestic meter. You've got this rhyme scheme. It's in couplets, rhyming couplets, anapests, you know, anapestic tetrameter. So there's a lot of other things to which you must pay attention. And then to mix it up, we have enjambed lines and really complicated syntax with, you know, interspersed with the occasional parenthetical interpolation.
Right.
It's like this one sentence, which is, you know, seven lines long. And that's nothing compared to Wordsworth, but Wordsworth writing in short lines in Tintern Abbey. Right. Yet in truth, unfulfilled the ambition and sterile the wealth in a life paralyzed by a moral ill health had remained. What had remained?
Yeah.
The truth, the ambition unfulfilled and the wealth sterile in truth had remained. There we go.
And, you know, this is precisely the problem that both Dryden and Pope wrote about. Dryden, in the Essay on Dramatic Poesy, said that if you have rhyme, then you don't have to do this kind of thing. And you can write more directly in common English syntax, and it would work as poetry. And Pope says the same thing in his commentary on his translation of the Iliad, that this is the problem that Milton fell into that rhyme can solve.
Exactly. And it's the thing that I teach my creative writing students. I say, do not, please remember, you're writing these, you know, rhyming couplets. Do not go mad with the syntax in order to force the couplets to get the rhymes in the right place. Because you're going to end up with something bizarre. And I should probably take this one little section of verse 4, canto 1, part 2 from Lucille and take it to class with them and show them, this is what I'm talking, this is what you're doing, stop. Yet in truth, unfulfilled the ambition. Unfulfilled the ambition. It sounds like the verb's totally inverted. And sterile the wealth, parenthetical, in a life paralyzed by a moral ill health, and parenthetical, comma, had remained, comma, while the beauty in youth, comma, unredeemed from a vague disappointment at all things, comma, but seemed day by day to reproach him in silence for all that lost youth in himself they had failed to recall. Mm-hmm. And then you read that, and even an attentive reader has to pause for a moment and say, wait a minute, what? They had failed to recall that lost youth in himself day by day, for which they reproached him in silence. For all of which they reproached him in silence.
You know, this is also a problem he's being forced into by the anapest.
Yeah.
Because anapestic rhythm is not the speech rhythm of English, whereas iambic pentameter is much closer to English speech. So unfulfilled the ambition. That's the only way he could get an anapest out
of that. Yet in truth, the ambition was unfulfilled. The wealth was sterile. And then you have the palation, and then you realize when you get to the fourth line that that's actually not the construct because it's had remained. That's the verb. The verb is remained, the last verb in that clause. Yes. Yet in truth, the ambition remained unfulfilled and the wealth had remained sterile in a life paralyzed by a moral ill health. That's the actual clause in normal English. But, you know, it's an anapestic tetrameter, so we can't write that. Instead, we get unfulfilled the ambition and sterile the wealth in a life paralyzed by a moral ill health had remained. Oh, good heavens. Well, you see, this is why, joking aside, we don't spend a lot of time these days reading and studying Owen Meredith, unless you're at the University of Iowa and you're a librarian, because they have put together a simply astonishing website where they have made an absolute academic fetish out of Lucille. And it's worth looking up. It's called the Lucille Project, the tagline of which is, quote, recovering the publication history of a single 19th century book. And they have done it. You can find every single edition of Lucille and all of the sub-variants of that edition ever. Like, I just clicked it, and then you get, like, a list of, like, 250 publishers, and you click the publisher, and then you get a list of, like, the hundreds of editions of Lucille that publisher printed. So I was almost able to find my own.
This was the advice I was given by one of my master's professors. He said, find some obscure text or group of texts that no one else cares to write about and make it yours, and you can publish on that for the rest of your life.
He's not wrong. He's not wrong, but you'll be miserable.
But Drew, there's part of me that looks at this website and fears that this is a especially severe form of punishment inflicted upon a junior librarian by a senior librarian.
You.
It could have been.
It doesn't look that way. No, that may be what it is, but I hope not. It looks like this is just this guy's labor of love. He's going to...
Or it could have been, you know, an apprenticeship for a graduate student. I could see this being a great project for a grad student.
He doesn't even work there anymore. He's an emeritus librarian. Sid Huttner, emeritus senior librarian, special collections in university archives, department head 1999 to 2011, book review editor until 2003 of the Guild of Book Workers, newsletter and book review editor for Rare Books and Manuscripts Librarianship till 1998.
Oh, now that's the clue. This was a labor of love for him.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Joint author with Elizabeth Steg Huttner of Register of Artists, Engravers, Booksellers, and Bookbinders, Printers, and Publishers in New York City, 1821 to 1842.
Wow.
Available from Oak Knoll Books and at all good booksellers.
All good booksellers.
And from 2014, Humanities eBook via ACLS to subscribing institutional libraries. There you go. And this was updated in June of last year, so he's keeping it up to date. Thanks. Thank you very much, Sid Huttner. It's astonishing.
You know, if he is scouring the internet for any mention of
he's going to find us.
He'll probably come across this. Yes, he will.
We're going to be featured. He's got 5,000 images of Lucille.
Wow.
5,000. I'm going to send him a picture because I have a slightly different cover than one of the ones he's got up there. And my version of the book has two extra pages because mine includes an index of first lines. And that was simply, well, that's just the gold standard. No one else had an index of first lines. This had an index of titles, but mine also includes an index of first lines, which adds an extra two pages to the manuscript. And none of the other editions he has include those extra two pages. So I'm going to send him a little note. Say, I found a variant, and it'll make his day. And he'll have to update his website.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's move on from Lucille. Sorry, Sid, if you're listening, we have to move on. We're going to talk about the chessboard now. And this was selected by Jack.
Yes. So this is the chessboard. My little love, do you remember, ere we were grown so sadly wise? Those evenings in the bleak December, curtained warm from the snowy weather, when you and I played chess together, checkmated by each other's eyes. Ah, I still see your soft white hand hovering warm o'er the queen or knight, brave pawns in valiant battle stand. The double castles guard the wings. The bishop, bent on distant things, moves, sliding through the fight. Our fingers touch, our glances meet, and falter falls. Your golden hair against my cheek, your bosom sweet is heaving. Down the field your queen rides slow, her soldiery all between, and checks me unaware. Ah me, the little battle's done, dispersed is all its chivalry. Full many a move since then have we midlife's perplexing checkers made, and many a game with fortune played. What is it we have won? This at least, if this alone, that never, never, never more, as in those old nights of yore, ere we were grown so sadly wise, can you and I shut out the skies, shut out the world in wintry weather, and eyes exchanging warmth with eyes, play chess as then we played together?
Why does this poem's rhyme scheme change halfway through?
Maybe it's a mirror of the chessboard, you know, which has
bizarre.
Both black and white squares.
You get three stanzas of A, B, A, C, C, B, and then the last two stanzas are A, B, B, C, C, A, A.
Because our narrator has been checkmated.
No, yep. Then they're not even, it's not even regular, because then the last one is A, A, B, B, A, B, A. So even the last two stanzas are totally unique. All right. If a student turned this in, I'd be annoyed. What's going on?
It
you
does have
three that are really regular, and then you go mad for two stanzas. Why did you go mad?
Well, love is madness, you know.
No, I see. Oh, okay. Yeah. Ah, me. Well, they begin with that changes. Ah, me, right? There's the madness. It's overwhelmed him. Ah, me. The little battle's done. The battle with the meter.
We're just winning both the chivalry and the meter.
Yeah, dispersed is all its meter. Full many a line since then have we written. Yeah, it's a bit frustrating to me. But I suppose
it does have some nice moments, though. I think it's clever in a way.
I don't like, again, the enjambments. He sometimes he knows how to use them, and sometimes he doesn't. So in the third stanza, our fingers touch, our glances meet and falter. Falls your golden hair against my cheek. I don't like that. Your bosom sweet is heaving. I really don't like that. Down the field, comma, your queen rides slow. That's fine. Her soldiery all between and checks me underwear. That's all fine, too. But that your bosom sweet and then the next line is heaving. I dislike that. That doesn't work for me. It's too something. Is he?
Well, when I think of heaving, I typically think of, you know, vomiting, heaving. So I think that I don't think that's a very good pairing.
No.
Well, I don't think that's the connotation it would have, though, at this time. I think it would be essential in the way that it's being used here.
Yes.
Quickly drawn breaths.
Yeah. I think it's heaving interesting bosom. To have combined such an intellectual game as chess with what is clearly a very sensual moment for both of them, where you know, the delicate hand, the breast moving up and down with the breath. I mean, it's this combination of the sensual and the intellectual that's really quite fascinating about it. Not to say it's a good poem, but it's
still a bad poem.
it's a bad poem, but it's about cool things.
But it does have redeeming qualities as a poem.
It does.
Right.
You know, if we working from Thomas Aquinas's principle of the convertibility of being and goodness, it does have some necessarily redeeming qualities as a poem. There are things about it that are poetic, but it's still pretty thoroughly bad.
And that's an interesting commentary on public taste, I think, that much of what becomes popular isn't really that exceptional.
No.
But it does have enough redeeming qualities that you can see why people liked it.
Yes. But I think the problem that Owen Meredith has, and we see this in both Lucille and, you know, in the example we looked at particularly, but also here, he doesn't really have a great deal of respect for syntax. And he's perfectly willing to do simply monstrous things to syntax in order to fit his meter.
I think this is the prime example of what T.S. Eliot was talking about when he said it was the bad following of Milton that led to such bad poetry in the 19th century.
And we also have
Milton's hands, it absolutely works, but it doesn't in the hands of a lesser poet.
And then we also have this paired with, I think, a willingness to go with rhymes that do not elevate the verse, right?
In the second stanza,
we see this.
Get.
the second stanza is really weak for that precise reason, that the lines are too simplistic, right? It's either the syntax is so horribly convoluted that something that it's a distraction, or the syntax is simplistic and so are the rhymes, McGonagall-like. So here we have in the second stanza, we have these lines. Ah, still I see your soft white hand hovering warm o'er queen or knight. Brave pawns in valiant battle stand, the double castles guard the wings, the bishop bent on distant things moves sliding through the fight. I don't know, that through the fight is just, it's too neat, right? It just neatly resolves, and I don't like it.
I think it's one of the best stanzas in the
book. It's so tidy.
That's unlike the rest of it, which isn't tidy at all.
This tidy. Doesn't mean that you can have, like, the opposite of badness can be badness. That's the problem. We've gone too far the other direction now.
Not a bad poetic description of a moment in a chess game.
No.
I mean, it reminds me slightly of the card game in Rape of the Lock.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
No, that's good.
So maybe there's a mock heroic element of this as well.
Another problem, we're going to see this in the last poem, which we're going to read in just a second, is in stanza three. Look at the way the third stanza ends. So here's a third stanza again, the very end of it, with one of those terrible syntactical things. So I have to begin a little earlier. Our fingers touch, our glances meet, and falters an enjambment. Falls your golden hair against my cheek. Look at the syntax, okay? Your bosom sweet is heaving. And then this. Down the field your queen rides slow, her soldiery all between, and checks me unawares, or checks me unaware. So that last line for me, this is like the signal that I'm reading an Owen Meredith poem. There's something about the firm, like closed nature, the tidy resolution, and the metricality of it, right? That it jostles against the rest of that stanza, and we're going to see it in the next poem. That exact thing, you'll hear it, and checks me unaware. Okay, so now it's my.
What did we think of? We commented on this before we started the recording, but the double checkmating.
Yeah, well, he hasn't been in chess, has he? You can't both be checkmated. That's not how it works. I mean, I appreciate what he's trying to say, but you still have to follow the rules of the metaphor, right? It's like
right.
Otherwise, you end up with a different. There's a word for that. I can't remember what it is. There's a special term. I think Mencken came up with it for that fallacy where the metaphor, you use it and the actual thing you're metaphorically connecting to, it doesn't work in the way you're using it. And I can't remember what it's called.
So it's an abuse of the metaphoric analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. The things have to be alike in the way in which you're comparing them. They have to still function. Otherwise, they're not metaphors. They're just being kind of, well, they're like the syntax, right? They're being bludgeoned into service. We don't want to bludgeon our syntax. We don't want to bludgeon our metaphors. And that's what's happening here. You can't both be in checkmate. You can both be in stalemate, but that ruins ruins the emotional content.
The word stale is distinctly unerotic. It brings to mind aging crackers, forgotten cheeses.
Things that are stuck, don't go anywhere. Yeah. Myers, right?
Fetid swamps.
Exactly. Well, we'll leave Bulwer Lytton here in this quagmire of his own making, and we'll move to our final poem, which is a song from the it's called one of his minor poems. It wasn't published as that. I'm sure it was just published somewhere, but it's included in the minor poems in the Complete Poetical Works. And this is my favorite Bulwer Lytton poem because it's so unspeakably bad. Simon Schama, when he was writing about the 19th century and writing about the Earl of Lytton, called him the noble but irredeemably bad poet, the Earl of Lytton. And I don't know if he's irredeemably bad, but this particular poem would suggest that he might be so. So here is a song from the minor poems. The purple iris hangs his head on his lean stalk and so declines. The spider spills his silver thread between the bells of columbines. An altered light and flickering eaves draws dews through these dim eyes of ours. Death walks in yonder waning bowers and burns the blistering leaves. Ah, well a day, blooms overblow, suns sink away, sweet things decay. The drunken beetle, roused ere night, breaks blundering from the rotting rose, flits through blue spidery aconite, and hums and comes and goes. His thick, bewildered song receives a drowsy sense of grief like ours. He hums and hums among the bowers and bangs about the leaves. Ah, well-a-day, hearts overflow, joy flits away, sweet things decay. Her yellow stars, the jasmine drops in mildewed mosses one by one. The hollyhocks fall off their tops, the lotus blooms all white in the sun. The freckled foxglove faints and grieves, the smooth-paced slumbrous slug devours the gluey globes of gorgeous flowers and smears the glistening leaves. Ah, well-a-day, life leaves us so, love dare not stay, sweet things decay. From brazen sunflowers, orb and fringe, the burning burnish dulls and dies. Sad autumn sets a sullen tinge upon the scornful peonies. The dewy frog limps out and heaves a speckled lump in speckled bowers. A reeking moisture clings and lowers the lips of lapping leaves. Ah, well-a-day, ere the cock crow, life's charmed array reels all away. I read that poem and I want to reel all away from it. It's...
The rotting rose.
I mean, where do you even begin? It's just, what
he's
on earth?
He's constantly reaching for something that has, you know, a heroic and immortal quality to it, but it always comes across as slightly comic. Yeah.
I suppose this is appropriate for a man who is Viceroy of India, right? You're representing the Empress, right? The Queen Empress. And what must you do? Well, we must paint all of the buildings. Every building must be painted pink. That's what we must do. Bunting. Bunting everywhere. There must be more bunting. And like, yes, like what is the purpose behind this, right? The purpose is to demonstrate British imperial power. How will we do it? By painting things pink. There is something bizarrely comic, unintentionally so, but like it's a byproduct of the effort, and his poetry does that. I mean, it's clear what he's trying to do here, right? It's like you're going to contrast life with decay, right, and death. So we're going to have images of decay. We're going to need the language of decay, the syntax, the tone of decay, and we're going to juxtapose it with the tone of like living things, like flowers. But it doesn't work because it has to be conveyed through a poem. And the poem can't do that. You can't have the poem breaking down into these absurd word choices.
These gluey globs of gorgeous
flowers. Yeah, and then the alliterative verse, right? As if the verses themselves are, you know, regressing. And they're moving backwards in time, becoming medieval. We're becoming alliterative verse, right? Everything, this is a poem that is de-evolving
gluey
before our eyes.
Gluey globes of gorgeous flowers.
Yeah. The gluey
globes. I mean, alliteration is, go ahead.
This brings to mind, I don't know if either of you have read Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but this sounds a lot like
Paula Nancy Millstone Jennings.
Well, which was the worst poet, or the second worst poetry that was fortunately destroyed.
Ode to a lump of something out of my armpit in the bath.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or the, let's see.
Prostetnik Vogon Jelts. That
as
we're going.
Plurtled, gabbled, blotness in midsummer mornings, on a lurgid bee,
yep,
into rancid, festering, confectious organ squealer. I mean, that does sound, yeah, a little bit like rotting roses.
It does.
And gluey globes of gorgeous flowers. So I think that...
he's got a bit of the prosthetic Vogon Jelts to him, doesn't he?
I think that Earl Lytton could have placed himself with pride among the
alongside the Vogon
poets.
Vogon poetry.
The thing is, the alliteration itself is a poetic quality, and it's not something that dropped out of English.
No, of course
not. Certainly still a fundamental element, but you've got to do it in a way that has a sort of subtlety to it.
Yeah, this is being beaten to death with alliteration.
Right, exactly.
The hardest possible consonants you could breaks blundering.
Explosive consonants, right? Like the G and the B, and then the worst is when you alliterate with S.
Smooth paced, slumbrous slug devours.
Yeah. You're hissing at that point.
The worst part is that some of these rhymes are overused as well, right? This is like the most, I don't know, the worst sin you can commit in rhyming poetry is to reuse your rhymes, in my opinion, mm-hmm. right? Don't do that. Don't, come on. And we only have so many rhymes for lowers. So every stanza contains the word bowers, right?
Yeah.
That in stanza one, it rhymes with hours. Right? Hours and bowers. In stanza two, we again have hours and bowers. The exact same rhyme. In stanza three, we get devours and flowers. Oh, wow. Happy day. But then in stanza four, back to bowers again. Bowers with lowers, which is a sight rhyme. Come now. And then what do we get in that fourth one when you the resurgence of bowers, right? The regurgitation of bowers is partnered up with a dewy frog that limps out and heaves a speckled lump. Where does he heave it? In the bowers. The in the regurgitation of the moment, the rhyme is regurgitated. Great. Thank you. Thank you for that poetic alliance. Imagery and verse. Tell my students, here's how you do it. You regurgitate the line as you regurgitate in the poem. Perfect. Bowers. A reeking moisture. Good.
Well, heavens. This is actually proof of the proposition that's repeated several times. Sweet things decay.
They loved it, though. They did love it.
Yes.
It was a sweet thing. And we look at it now, we're like, good grief. What happened in the 19th century that this made it into print? And as much as I say that, though, I do think to myself, this is still better than 90% of the poetry I read. So,
well, because it attempts to have musicality to it, and
it's competent.
Nowadays,
you know,
right?
But it is competent.
I think that we are so far reacting against anything that is confidently musical.
Yes.
That we actually try to be as unmusical as possible.
I agree entirely. Because if you write something musical, people will then accuse you of being old-fashioned, as if musicality is old-fashioned. I read a lot of acclaimed verse from some of my friends, who I will not mention their names, and they're totally lacking in music. They applaud one another, and they say, oh, that line just sings. And it sings in the way that a parson reading a sermon sings, which is to say it doesn't sing. And I wonder, where's the lightness? At least this, it tries.
Yeah, it has a song-like quality. Yeah.
It lifts, at times it lifts, and some of the word choices are very nice, but then it falls down the stairs, you know, because of what it's trying to do, which is as much a problem with the, you know, the intent behind the poem as it is with the construction.
But the same thing happens in much of contemporary classical music. I mean, anything that's too melodious is sort of shunned like a plague by the most critically acclaimed classical composers today. And that is looked at as it's sort of, you know, crass in a pop music kind of way, because pop music still tries to sound, you know, at least song-like.
Well, I think it did. I don't know if it does anymore. Certainly in the 80s and 90s, I think it did.
Yeah, yeah.
Occasionally I hear the radio nowadays, and it doesn't, it's so bad. They don't even sing anymore. It's just computers doing the voices, and it's terrible. I was having my hair cut last week, and I was forced to listen to the pop music station, and I was ready to be done. They said, do you want scissors on top like usual? I'm like, no, use the clippers. Get me out of here. Get it done with. Okay. Well, so much for Owen Meredith, who has not perhaps fared as well in the long view of history as he might otherwise have done if he were able to achieve that noble goal that he had intended, to write beautiful epics in a modern vein. Maybe it's better just to write like Milton. Maybe we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Maybe we shouldn't modernize our language. Maybe Wordsworth and Coleridge and the rest of the Romantics were wrong, and we should just be writing couplets like Pope in the same syntax and style. Not an imitation, but just, this worked, let's do that sort of mentality. But no one would publish you these days if you did that.
Richard Wilbur got a great deal of publication and fame for standard Popian style couplets.
Yeah. Maybe it's time to bring them back. Write like Pope. My students in creative writing learn early that the second most cited poet in English is Pope. Mm-hmm. So write like Pope. Worked for him. Okay. Well, that's enough Owen Meredith. And we hope that you've enjoyed our first April episode. We always like to have a little fun with that first episode in April. And we've done McGonagall, and it seemed only fair to trot out Owen Meredith. Next week, something a little more serious. Where shall we go? Where shall we go next week? Thoughts?
Didn't we have something in mind?
I think we did. You're gonna go further back. I just wanted to pause here on Meredith.
Jack wanted to do a metaphysical poet.
Yes,
that, right.
I think that I can't remember his name, but he did pick one. Victor, someone.
Was it Vaughn?
Vaughn. There it is. Yes. Yeah. We'll go to Vaughn. Next week, Vaughn. I've never read Vaughn. Henry Vaughn, is that it? Yeah?
Yep.
Henry Vaughn. Okay. Next week, Henry Vaughn. I've never read Henry Vaughn. This will be an eye-opening experience for me. And it will be substantially more serious than blundering beetles banging about the leaves.
Beetle. Owen Meredith is a critical reading only in a kind of negative sense, a necessary contrast to the best.
What to avoid, right? Don't do this. Don't do this. It bangs about the leaves. All right. Well, I love that song. I think it's just the funniest thing. I mean, it's entirely unintentional. It's meant to be very serious meditation on, you know, it's a sort of memento mori, and instead it's absurd. Gluey globes, heaves, it's reeking moisture. Okay. Enough. This podcast wouldn't be possible.
Reel away.
Indeed. Reel away. Sweet things decay. Well a day. Well, we are going to reel away. And this podcast would not be possible without the support of listeners like you. So thank you ever so much to all of our patrons. And if you'd like to join them in helping to offset our server costs, head to criticalreadings.com and click that Become a Patron button. And for a very, very tiny sum of money every month, you can help to make sure that we remain online. So thank you ever so much. We will put your name in the credits. And also, this podcast wouldn't be possible without my panelists this week. They were Drew Keene.
It's been a pleasure.
And Jack Tyler.
Until next week.
And I'm Dr. Cooper. We will be back in 1 week with the poetry of Henry Vaughn, a metaphysical poet. Until then, from all of us here at Critical Readings, Godspeed. You've been listening to Critical Readings. With special thanks to our supporters, Turnus, Alessandro, Lisa, and Elizabeth. Copyright John Philip Cooper. All rights reserved.